Okay, Courtney Austin, are you in here? You are in here. Hey, everybody, this is Courtney. She's going to read for us this morning. I'm not even going to set us up. We're just going to hop into the Word. This is John 4, maybe a familiar story, Jesus talking with the Samaritan woman at the well.
John 4.
Let's make sure we're on. Are we on? Yeah, are we on?
John 4,
we're on.
Verses 1 through 30 and 39. Now Jesus learned that the Pharisees had heard that he was gaining and baptizing more disciples than John, although in fact it was not Jesus who baptized, but his disciples. So he left Judea and went back once more to Galilee. Now he had to go through Samaria. So he came to a town in Samaria called Sychar, near the plot of ground Jacob had given to his son Joseph. Jacob's well was there, and Jesus, tired as he was from the journey, sat down by the well. It was about noon. When a Samaritan woman came to draw water, Jesus said to her, "Will you give me a drink?" His disciples had gone into the town to buy food. The Samaritan woman said to him, "You are a Jew, and I'm a Samaritan woman. How can you ask me for a drink?" For Jews do not associate with Samaritans. Jesus answered her, "If you knew the gift of God and who it is that asks you for a drink, you would have asked him and he would have given you living water." "Sir," the woman said, "you have nothing to draw with and the well is deep. Where can you get this living water? Are you greater than our father Jacob, who gave us the well and drank from it himself, as did also his sons and his livestock?" Jesus answered, "Everyone who drinks this water will be thirsty again, but whoever drinks the water I give them will never thirst. Indeed, the water I give them will become in them a spring of water welling up to eternal life." The woman said to him, "Sir, give me this water so that I won't get thirsty and have to keep coming here to draw water." He told her, "Go, call your husband and come back." "I have no husband," she replied. Jesus said to her, "You are right when you say you have no husband. The fact is, you've had five husbands, and the man you now have is not your husband. What you have just said is quite true." "Sir," the woman said, "I can see that you are a prophet. Our ancestors worshipped on this mountain, but you Jews claim that the place where we must worship is in Jerusalem." "Woman," Jesus replied, "believe me, a time is coming when you will worship the Father neither on this mountain nor in Jerusalem. You Samaritans worship what you do not know. We worship what we do know, for salvation is from the Jews. Yet a time is coming, and it has now come, when the true worshipers will worship the Father in the spirit and in truth. For they are the kind of worshipers the Father seeks. God is spirit, and his worshipers must worship in the spirit and in truth." The woman said, "I know that Messiah called Christ is coming. When he comes, he will explain everything to us." Then Jesus declared, "I, the one speaking to you, I am he." Just then, his disciples returned and were surprised to find him talking with the woman. But no one asked, "What do you want?" or "Why are you talking with her?" Then leaving her water jar, the woman went back to the town and said to the people, "Come, see a man who told me everything I ever did. Could this be the Messiah?" They came out of the town and made their way toward them. Many of the Samaritans from that town believed in him because of the woman's testimony. "He told me everything I ever did." The word of the Lord.
Thanks be to God. All right. Here we go. Three things. I'm going to really move quickly through the first one. Misunderstood mission. This is the second one's where we're going to camp out mostly. Misunderstood thirst. And then lastly, misunderstood worship. So we're talking about Jesus being misunderstood, people not understanding who he is, why he's doing what he's doing, saying what he's saying. So misunderstood mission, misunderstood thirst, and misunderstood worship. So first thing, misunderstood mission. Jesus, it says there in verse 1 and 2 that he's getting some attention for what he's doing, healings that he's doing, lots of different things, which is creating tension. And we, because we have the rest of Scripture, we understand that there's this impending clash that's going to come that we'll celebrate, you know, Good Friday and Easter, this impending clash with the Pharisees, but it's not yet time for that. Remember when he was at the wedding of Cana and he said, my hour is not yet come. It's not time for me to die yet. So Jesus, it says there that he slips back into Galilee, but he has to pass through Samaria in order to do that. So he's kind of avoiding this clash and he's moving back over to Judea, but he's going, or sorry, to Galilee, but he's going through Samaria. And it's pretty clear based on this interaction that we see unfold between Jesus and this woman and her reaction to Jesus, plus the disciples' surprise there at the end, that the Jews and the Samaritans, they don't associate with one another, they don't have a good relationship. And I could spend a lot of time kind of going into great detail about why that was the case. There was a war between the Assyrians and God's people, and the Assyrians took them captive. Centuries prior to this, the Samaritan people were kind of the descendants of that conflict, and they were actually part Assyrian, part Jew. So they had kind of this religious cocktail of beliefs and practices, some of which were Jewish, right? But some were also made up of this former Assyrian and kind of multi-religious, multi-plural religions. And so they were half Jew, half Assyrian, and therefore to kind of the pure Jew of the day, they were second class or worse. They were somebody to not be associated with. So the fact that Jesus is interacting with this woman, which would have not happened for a rabbi in those days, for a rabbi to be having a one-on-one conversation with a woman, let alone a Samaritan woman, let alone a woman who apparently has a questionable sexual past, right? Five husbands and now is with another man. This was kind of a three-strike situation, right? But Jesus is having this conversation. He's engaging this woman, and he doesn't just kind of shrug, you know, history for history's sake. Every word, every deed, Scripture says, every action is intentional and purposeful by Jesus. So the first thing we see here is that everyone, including this Samaritan woman, they are misunderstanding the scope of Jesus, his salvation, his mission of redemption. That it was true that he says there, yes, salvation comes through the Jews because Jesus was of Jewish descent. But that salvation, that mission of redemption was not just for the Jewish people. It was not only for them. His salvation was going to extend to every tongue and tribe. It was going to fulfill that covenant that he started with Abraham back in Genesis 15 and 17. Which for us, it was true for them too, but it creates a problem because most tribes, right, most groups of people, whether it was Jews or Samaritans or us today, we all have tribes. Even within Nashville, we have kind of tribes of people. Then and now, we can be terribly protective of our own territory, right? We can be incredibly nationalistic, interested only in our advancement and our blessing and not the blessing of the world or the blessing of other people. All you have to look at in our current kind of geopolitical climate, we see this, right? Here in America, but you see it everywhere, right? People kind of protecting and interested in their own turf. I saw it just simply in road rage driving to the beach, right? I'm trying to get where I'm going. It's me first. It's me only. Get out of my way. So we see it in huge ways, and we see it in little ways in ourselves. So this is not a new problem, us kind of misunderstanding the scope of who Jesus and where Jesus is working. It's as old as time, and it's as old as sin. But clearly, Jesus is on a mission for this woman. He's on a mission for her. He's on a mission for her heart. It says there that he... And this is, I think, John kind of knowing postscript, post his death and resurrection, when he says he had to go through Samaria, that actually isn't true. It's John kind of understanding as the author, there was something redemptive going on here that we only understood later on. Because there were lots of other ways to get to Samaria, or to get to Galilee versus going through Samaria. There were other ways to go around, and for a really devout Jewish, especially a Jewish rabbi, they would have gone a longer route just to not have to associate with a Samaritan. So it isn't true that he had to go that way. But what was true was that to be faithful to the mission that he was called on by the Father, Jesus did have to go. Right? He could have taken a longer route, but Jesus going on this route was less about his convenience and more about necessity, more about his call, more about his mission. I have come to do the will of the one who has sent me. So the Samaritan woman misunderstands his mission. The disciples are still misunderstanding his mission. What was his mission? Well, we get to that in the second point, which is misunderstood thirst. Jesus' mission, I kind of want to slow down here. Jesus' mission was her deepest and truest thirst. It was her deepest and her truest thirst. So this woman, it says here in the passage, that she goes to the well at noon, in the sixth hour at noon, in the middle of the day. And she's going there alone, which for a woman to go to the well alone at any time would have been a dangerous thing. But to go to the well at noon alone would have been really odd. Okay, lots of commentary about this, but it would not have been a normal time for a woman to go draw water at this well, and certainly to not go by herself. There's lots of people who are trying to throw out a lot of explanations, but oftentimes the simplest one is the right one, right? The most likely explanation is that a woman with her reputation was trying to avoid interactions with other women and other people. I'm trying to go here because I don't want to be around anybody else, and nobody else really probably wants to be around me. I'm trying to avoid the community. And what happens here? Jesus says, you know, he's thirsty, he's tired, his disciples have gone into town to buy food. Jesus says to her, "Will you give me a drink?" Right? "Will you give me a drink?" She expresses shock at that request, right? Asking based on the fact that he's a Jew and she's a Samaritan. And then Jesus slowly but eventually kind of changes the conversation. And he changes the conversation from one that they were kind of on the surface talking about physical thirst to a conversation about her existential thirst. And she doesn't, for a long time in this conversation, let Jesus in. She doesn't really go along. She kind of just holds him at bay with her kind of responses and even some of her deflection, all right? Let's go to verse 10. He says, you know, "Give me a drink." Samaritan woman says, "You're a Jew. I'm a Samaritan." This is verse 9. "How can you ask me for a drink?" Jews don't associate with Samaritans. Jesus asked her, "If you knew the gift of God and who it is that asks you for a drink, you would have asked him for something, and he would have given you living water." She says, "Sir, you have nothing to draw with, and the well is deep. Where can you get this living water?" So Jesus asked her for something, right? "Give me a drink." And then she comes to find that he's actually there to give her something. And he said, "If you understood who I am, and you understood," because she doesn't understand, "what I had to offer you, you'd be asking me for something right now. For living water, for springs of living water." The term there, living water, in kind of its ordinary usage of the day, would have referred to a spring, right? A spring that like bubbles up, or a stream, like actual flowing water, versus like a cistern. I don't know if some of you maybe even still have cisterns. Some people in our family still have cisterns where you actually dump water into it and it's just kind of like a giant holding tank. Some wells were like that in the day. There's a lot of debate whether this well had a spring or not. But think of living or flowing or fresh water. When we were in Florida this week, there were ponds. You ever just see ponds that are kind of like covered in scum, right? Because there's no water in, no water out. They're just kind of stagnant, right? This is very different image here. It's like, no, this is actually, I guess it's kind of like a swimming pool. There's circulation going on, right? There's something coming into it and freshening it up all the time. Think not stagnant, but fresh, alive, satisfying, living water is perpetual thirst-quenching water. And Jesus is saying, and he's comparing something, what you've come to get here at this well with your bucket and your rope versus what I have to offer you. This is what I'm here to do for you, and she doesn't get it. She looks on the surface, she says, "Hey, you don't even have anything to draw water with." Right? You don't even have something to get down into the well with. And then she says something really interesting here. She says, "Are you greater than our father Jacob, who gave us this well and drank from it himself, as did his sons and livestock?" So she kind of checks Jesus a little bit. Like, hey man, who do you think you are? Right? You think you're greater than Jacob, who was a Jewish patriarch? Do you actually think you're greater than he is? She kind of checks Jesus, But eventually she says there in verse 15, "Sir, give me this water so that I won't get thirsty and have to keep coming here to draw water. Give me the water." So she's open, starting to kind of soften. "Give me this water," but she still thinks it's about the water there in the well. And here goes Jesus, okay? Just think about this for a second in this conversation. "Sir, give me the water so I won't have to keep coming back here. You've got this magic water, I guess, right?" Jesus says this, "Go call your husband and come back." Dun, 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 right? Wait a sec, I thought we were talking about water. "Go call your husband and come back." And she says this, "I have no husband." Jesus, he's there to give her something. He's not there to get something from her. So Jesus, who understands the thirst that she has, and she does not understand it at this point, he changes the conversation to actually awaken her to the consideration that your thirst is about something deeper than what we're talking about. Your thirst is about something deeper than you're acknowledging. And so I'm going to get you to wake up to that thirst by bringing up something that you don't want to talk about. Something that's got you here at this well in the middle of the day all alone. "Go and call your husband." She says, "I have no husband." Which in many ways, I mean, it's a very clever, I mean, you could honestly have a lot of compassion for this woman because she's probably had to master a life of kind of deflecting and just kind of keeping this at bay. She tries to deflect and Jesus gets really direct. Right? What does he say to her? He says, "You're right when you say you have no husband. The fact is you've had five husbands and the man you have now is not your husband. What you've said is quite true." He basically does this. He says, "I may not have a bucket or a rope, but I don't need one to get to the bottom of the well of the real thirst in your life. That has a wake. Your life has this wake that is marked by isolation, that is marked by shame. It's marked by being outcast really from the community by your actions. And your thirst to belong and your thirst to be known and your thirst to be loved, that's what I'm here to talk about. That's what I'm here to address. I'm here to talk about the life from jumping from one well to the next in the form of a man, the well she was continuing to go to that had not delivered on the life that she desired. Because if she had just been widowed five times, there would have been no shame. In fact, she would have been taken care of by the community. But this situation, she's at least partially to blame for why she's here. And Jesus is driving her. He's leading her. He's gently leading her and us to consider. And this is where I want us to kind of camp out and make it personal. Do you know what your thirst is really about? Do you? Like, do you know what your desire for more is really about at the core? Like, one of the proverbs that has kind of defined my life in a season where Jesus was teaching me deeply about how much I misunderstood my thirst was Proverbs 19:22. You could spend a lot of time just in Proverbs 19 in the wisdom literature of the Old Testament, but Proverbs 19:22 says this, what a person desires is unfailing love, better to be poor than a liar. So the first part of that's pretty clear, pretty understandable on the nose. What you desire, what I desire, what you were created for was to be in a relationship where love, an unfailing love, was reality. You were designed and desire unfailing love. The second half of the proverb is a little harder to understand, which is this: it's better to be poor than actually to be a liar. What that's saying is this: it's better to not have all the things that you believe could deliver on that unfailing love succeeding for you than to live in the lie that you actually were made for unfailing love. It's better to be poor. It's better to not have all these things than to live in the lie that what I was made for was unfailing love. I don't know about you, but I can bet so much of my life in my teens and my 20s, was spent misunderstanding what my thirst was actually really all about. What my desire and who my desire was actually for. And the reality is, much like this woman, I ruined many relationships. Many. And I'm not just talking about dating ones, friendships, my relationship to my academics, to my work. I ruined so many things because I was bringing the weight of that thirst that only Jesus can satisfy. I was bringing the weight of that thirst, what Ecclesiastes 3 calls the weight of eternity. He has placed eternity in your hearts. You walk around, I walk around with bits of heaven inside of us. Do you know that? Do you know the danger of not knowing that? That you're bringing that to your spouse, that you're bringing that to your children, that you're bringing that to your vocation, that you're bringing that to this community. No marriage, no successful vocation, no successful occupation, no kids being happy and being whole, no intimacy or sex life, no community or friends or church or school, no accolades or public praise, all which are good and God-given things, and they have their place. But none of that can handle the weight of the thirst that he's talking about. You follow me? Here's what I'm saying. I think what Jesus is saying, if we don't have the kind of relationship with Jesus that is addressing that deepest thirst, if we aren't experiencing what he is saying, this is a gift that only I can give. I'm the only one who can give this living water. Then we do bring that thirst that only God can satisfy. We bring it to one another. We bring it to something mortal, some mortal being or some material thing or endeavor, to something that we ultimately can't keep, that is too fragile, that is too small, and it buckles under the weight of it. And we shouldn't be surprised when they fail and come up short because they were never designed to. My wife was never, she's designed to reflect Jesus to me. She's not designed to be Jesus for me. Only Jesus can be Jesus for me. Nashville is a thirsty city, y'all. It's full of thirsty people, us. Thirsty for what's new, thirsty for what's next, thirsty for more approval, for more significance, for more beauty, for more understanding, and we have the bachelor parties and the new builds to prove it. Don't we? We're thirsty. Do we know? Do you know? Would you dare to just stop with Jesus at the well, whatever well you're sitting at, and go, do I really know what I'm thirsty for? Do I understand what David said? Psalm 42, when he's saying, my soul thirsts like the deer pants for the water, my soul thirsts for God alone. That is not a feeling, that is a statement of fact. I have a thirst that only he can quench. Do we know what our thirst is about? And do we understand the consequences of not understanding that? Proverbs 19, 2 and 3, desire without knowledge is not good. If you have a desire that you don't understand what it's about, that's not good. Because in your haste, it says, how much more will hasty feet miss the way? In my haste, I will run after something, believing that that's what my desire is about, and I'll miss it. And it says, a man's own folly leads to his ruin, and yet his heart rages against God. I'm raging against God. And he's saying, your thirst isn't about that, it's about me. Let me show you a picture. This came to me from one of my college roommates. This is 30 years ago. It came to me this week. You know who that is? Me. I know. It's falling apart, isn't it? That's Dave Burden as a senior in college. Let me tell you about that guy. That guy was on top of the world in the eyes of so many people. I was senior class president. I had more friends than you could count. I was busy. I was moving a million miles an hour. I had so many relationships and so many responsibilities. I was, as they say these days, killing it, right? I even bought a Dalmatian. because I needed a cute sidekick, right? I was known by everyone, and yet I didn't know myself at all. You would have thought I was not thirsty at all. I was full. But I didn't not only know myself, I didn't even know Jesus at that point. And I was a Christian. I knew about him, but I didn't know him. That guy, all of that energy and all of that pursuit and all of that running from well to well to well was trying to quench this dehydrated Dave who was so thirsty for belonging and could never quite get enough of it, who was so thirsty for praise he could not ever quite get enough of these, who was so insecure, who was so full of fear, and who was so using even good religious things, using people and activity and accomplishment to try to quench that thirst. And God, in his kindness, finally got me alone at a well, except it was a pig farm and a single wide trailer and almost 2 years of being taken completely to just be with Jesus. I don't recommend it, and I kind of do. Sorry, you mean you might be at a pig farm and not even know it right now. He might have you at your well, and you're trying so hard to get away from it, and he's trying so hard to set you free. Would you just sit there and let him keep walking you into your heart? Because it was in that place of being totally alone and totally isolated, shoveling you know what all day long for thankless pigs for $6 an hour, that I finally met the Jesus that this woman met. Because I am her. And you are too if you don't know it. So here's the invitation, just some application about our thirst. Jesus, just like he did with this woman, just like he did with me, he has to reveal to us that there is something deep, a thirst that is deep in us that we don't fully understand, but he has to reveal that to us in order to give us something. And how he does that, let me tell you how he did it with me. He's doing it with her, and I think it's how he does it with us. He's got to confront the water source that you're going to all the time, that you believe is going to deliver on the thing that is going to make life life. And oftentimes what that looks like is he's got to poke on a wound like he does with this woman or he did with me. He's got to poke on some wound. He's got to expose us in some certain way. He's got to kind of use pain in some ways to kind of agitate us, to kind of wake up, to receive the gift and the person who gives the gift. He's going to bring something to the surface that's actually preventing us from receiving him. That's why he sent the prophets in the Old Testament. This is from Jeremiah 2. He says, "My people have committed two sins. They have forsaken me, the spring of living water, and they have dug their own cisterns, broken cisterns that can't hold water." Do you hear what he's saying? I mean, this is centuries later. Jeremiah was talking about this. You have a problem. It's as old as time. It's as old as sin. You're forsaking the giver of living water, and instead you're digging your own pond. It's a broken pond, it's a broken cistern, and it cannot hold the water that you were designed to drink from. So the invitation is this. Would you just examine this week, what well am I coming to? Because we're all going somewhere. It's like what Janie said earlier. We're all worshiping somewhere. We're all running to some well to quench that thirst. What is it for you? Hoping it's going to be the living water. Here's one of the ways you can figure it out. This is one of the ways I figured out. When I'm caught in a case of the if-onlys, okay? You ever get a, that's like a cough, right? Like a lingering cough. I've got a lingering case of the if-onlys where I'm going, if only this, then, dot, dot, dot. Whatever you answer if only after, that's one of your wells that you're going to, probably hoping it's going to give you what only Jesus can. When I'm caught in a case of if-onlys, oftentimes I'm like a well hopper, right? I kind of like stop at this well for a little while, see if it's going to do it. Instead of stopping, how many wells do I have to go to before I stop and say, maybe I'm not going to any of the right wells. Maybe I don't even understand what my thirst is all about. Maybe there's something in the composition of who God's created me to be that I've never really fully known or embraced that is about me receiving something from him, a thirst that has to be quenched by him alone. That all these little wells, they kind of hint at, but they don't really fully acknowledge or encompass. I'd read you a C.S. Lewis quote, but we don't have time. But he believes that too. There you go. You heard it from me. Go read The Weight of Glory. Last thing we see, because he's leading her, do you understand what your thirst is all about? Jesus is drawing close, and after he's exposed a wound for her in order to heal her, because Proverbs also says wounds from a friend can be trusted. Sometimes the Lord has to wound us to heal us. He says this, she says this in verse 19. After he says, you've had five husbands, and the one you're with isn't even your husband. You're right. You're true. It's true. You don't have a husband right now. She says this, I can see that you're a prophet. Our ancestors worship on this mountain, but you Jews claim that the place where we must worship is in Jerusalem. He's getting so close, and she's like, okay, I'm going to turn this conversation now into a discussion about kind of religious differences, about where Samaritans say you should worship and where Jews say you should worship. Let's kind of get away from talking about my personal life, okay? And Jesus takes her deflecting as an opportunity to kind of further expose her need. And he says this, you Samaritans, you worship what you don't know. Us Jews, we worship what we do know. But some time is coming. And this is such a powerful statement, y'all. Verse 21, he says, woman, believe me, there's a time, and don't miss this, when you will worship. Now that you is plural, but it's inclusive. I'm talking to you, lady. What you want to talk about where, you know, this building or this mountain or this place. This isn't about a place. This is about a posture, worshiping in spirit and in truth, which if God is spirit, you can't even worship God without me giving you myself. And you don't even understand all the truth, and I've got to reveal that to you. But you are going to come to understand that worshiping me is a matter of spirit and truth, and real worship is something that I do. I seek you out. It's powerful. A time is coming now when true worshipers will worship the Father in spirit and in truth, for they are the kind of worshipers the Father seeks. You hear what he's saying? God's seeking you out. True worshipers. We hear that and we think, people who are pure of heart, who have all of the worship practices correctly, they worship at the right place, they understand the truth perfectly. She's none of those things. Hey, there's coming a time where you're going to worship. You will worship the Father, neither on this mountain or in Jerusalem. Do you see what's happening right now? I've got to give you the truth. I've got to reveal to you your thirst. I've got to give you a spirit. You will only worship me accordingly and appropriately if I give something to you. He is bringing this woman to salvation. How? I'm going to have to expose some brokenness in your life, some wounds in your life, some false wells. I'm going to have to deepen your understanding of your thirst in order to quench that thirst with a true and better husband, me. You could almost rewrite the proverb for her. You know, what a man desires is unfailing love, better to be poor than a liar. I'm bringing you to the one who is unfailing love, and it's better to be in a waterless life than to live in the lie that that is your greatest thirst and your greatest need. So she's still kind of hanging on here in verse 25. I promise I'm almost finished. I know that the Messiah, the Christ, is coming, and when he comes, he will explain everything to us. Then Jesus declared, I, the one speaking to you, I am he. It's me. I'm here. Think about this for a second. He's running away from the religious elites. That's where the passage begins, right? He's trying to not reveal himself to the religious elite people. And yet he's here fighting for and revealing himself to the most broken and ashamed woman. If you're going to worship in spirit and in truth, I have to do something for you. And only the broken know that. Only the people who have been humbled, maybe even humiliated, understand that. For you to worship me rightly, for the thirsts in your life to be ordered properly. Let me say that again. The thirsts in your life to be ordered properly. I've got to give you living water. Okay. How do we see it happen in our life? Last thing I'll say is this. She leaves her jar. Remember, she's all like, you can't get water from here. I got the thing that gets water from here. You don't even have the thing that gets water from here. Are you better than Jacob? All of a sudden, we see her leaving the thing that she has to use to get water. She leaves her jar, right? The woman went back to the town and said to the people, come and see a man who told me everything I ever did. Could this be the Messiah? Now, if I'm Jesus, this is the last person I want to break the news for me. Right? I don't want to send her as my spokesperson, right? And yet, she's clearly effective. It says there in 39, many people came to him, right? They came and heard what he had to share. But here's what she said. Here was her hook to bring him in. And this is astounding, y'all. I spent the whole week meditating on this one statement. Come and see a man who told me everything I ever did. Seriously? How many of you want to be a person where Jesus tells you, I know everything you ever did? Like, if you heard someone say, come meet this person, he's going to expose to you, and particularly the things that you're ashamed of, everything that you ever did. And everyone came. I mean, we're in a cancel culture, right? Can you imagine if everything you ever did, someone exposed that, and then all of a sudden something flipped in you that you were like, that's my greatest tool of evangelism, is to go say, he saw all of me, all of the brokenness, all of the shame, all of the bad. And somehow she doesn't feel condemned. And that's because she's coming to Jesus. Because there is no condemnation for those who are in Christ Jesus. When the Spirit's at work, he doesn't expose stuff to condemn us. He exposes stuff to cure us, to set us free. And do you not see that in this woman? She's free. The isolated woman moves back towards community and says, come on. That's what free people do. Free people, free people. Come get set free from your shame, from your worry, from your isolation, from your fear. Come on. Come and see. Would you dare to believe? We don't believe this. We believe the best tool for reaching people with the gospel is our piety. No, it's not. It's our neediness. It's our weakness. It's our brokenness. It's not our togetherness. I don't ever connect with people over our strengths. That's called competition. I connect with people who we both know how bad we needed somebody to do something for us that we could not have done for ourselves, and that's what she found. Come and see the man who told me everything I ever did and didn't hold it against me, but broke all the rules. Broke the rules of talking to a woman, broke the rules of talking to a woman who had her past, broke the rules of talking to a Samaritan woman because he was coming after me to make me a true worshiper. So would you come and see him? Maybe you've never been to that well with Jesus. Maybe you've been to church your whole life and you've never gotten in touch with the fact that your thirst is about one thing. Nothing Nashville has to offer you is about this. It's him. He's it. Would you come to him? And if you know that Jesus, would you run into your community and say, come and meet the person who saw everything I ever did and loved me? It's a powerful healing experience. It's called grace, y'all. It's what we'll celebrate at Easter. So get ready. Let me pray. Jesus, whew. Thank you that you are not content to let us sit indefinitely at wells that will not quench our thirst. that you are a good friend who's even willing to expose our deepest shame because you want to set us free from it, from even our pride, and actually create humility and openness to receive the living water that only you give us. Reveal to me, reveal to my friends here, what wells we're sitting at that we need to be set free from. Let me ask this in your name.